From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. Historians have explored warfare through just about every lens you can think of. Economics, politics, religion, biographies. But leave it to political scientists and Watson fellow Peter Andreas to use the lens you haven't thought of, drugs. We're not talking about the war on drugs. This is no metaphor. Peter's newest book is called Killer High, A History of War in Six Drugs. He describes how these drugs, from coffee to opium, have affected not only how, but why we fight. The book is filled with surprises. It's bound to make you see both drugs and war in a whole new light. And even what you think you know on the topic probably isn't the way it is.
People look back at drug problems in Vietnam, people think heroin, people might think cannabis, but frankly, amphetamines were as serious or more serious problem, not to mention alcohol as well, which we often forget about.
I started a little farther back than Vietnam, though, with what Peter sees as one of the most powerful drug cartels of all time, the British East India Company. Here's Peter.
Today, we're obsessed with drug traffickers from Mexico and Colombia and even use grandiose terms like cartels. But if you really look at the definition of cartel, they don't come anywhere resembling what a cartel is. But actually, the British East India Company did come pretty damn close to being a cartel. They dominated trade to such an extent, it's not a monopoly, but they control and influence the trade to such an extent that they can, you know, come close to setting prices. I mean, OPEC aspires to be, as we talk about the OPEC cartel, it aspires to do that. But even OPEC doesn't actually function as a true cartel. But the British East India Company can easily be described as the largest drug trafficking organization the world has ever seen.
Can you give us a little history about
that? Well, the history is essentially they ran the opium trade between, you know, colonial India and China, which at the time was the world's largest consumer market for opium. This is, you know, in the 18th century, but then really ramped up in the 19th century. Also, I should point out, British East India Company was crucial in the tea trade and also in India becoming the world's largest producers of tea. At one point, China monopolized that, and then production, thanks to the British, shifted to India, and the British East India Company was responsible for much of that.
States make drug war and drug war makes states. This notion that the drugs war relationship is about statecraft is intriguing to me. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean?
Sure. Part of what I mean is to push back against the conventional wisdom in policy debates that the beneficiaries of the drugs war relationship are stateless actors like insurgents and warlords and terrorists and militias and traffickers. Because from a bigger historical look at this issue, it's clear that big, powerful states, England, Russia, right? These are built up significantly thanks to drug revenue. So for example, Russia, how does the Tsar build up the largest army, standing army in continental Europe? Vodka revenue. How does Britain rise to become the world's leading maritime naval power? Alcohol taxes, revenue from tea, revenue from opium. These are huge pillars, financial pillars of the British Empire in the 19th century.
And yet sometimes they backfire, right?
They do backfire. I mean, the Boston Tea Party certainly backfired.
And the Russian army was drunk?
The Russian army was not just funded by vodka revenue, but unfortunately imbibed a fair amount of alcohol. And so probably one of the more alcoholic armies the world has seen. Still a serious problem. There's other examples too. The French Revolution, obviously complicated roots, but one often glossed over, unrecognized, is popular hatred of tobacco taxes, right? So the king had imposed pretty steep taxes on things like tobacco.
Louis XVI.
Right, and anyone who tried to grow tobacco themselves or smuggle tobacco, harsh penalties, entire, you know, enforcement outfits sent out to stamp that down. And so part of the resentment and anger that contributed to the French Revolution was there's a tobacco angle there too.
Let's turn to alcohol now, because that's a fascinating war lubricant, as you write. You say it was sort of a form of liquid courage, but it was also taxable. It was a source of revenue for states. And also, I didn't think of it as the world's oldest mass consumption drug.
Right.
But you make the case that it is. So in tracing alcohol in early American history, I was really struck by your description of it as an ethnic cleanser. Can you just talk about what that meant? Like, it was a substitute for war.
Sure. Or another way to look at it is a weapon of war. Not a substitute for war, but as a weapon of war.
So talk about
the
expansion.
You just look at the impact of introducing hard liquor on Native American populations, it was absolutely devastating. As devastating as any bullets, for that matter. Some of it was unintentional, and some of it was quite purposeful.
As an aid to westward expansion?
Yes, absolutely. The debilitating effect of alcohol in weakening and, in some extent, exterminating Native American populations, I mean, often blamed are, of course, disease, war itself, but I think we should also add alcohol. I don't want to overstate it, but it's often overlooked as literally as an ethnic cleanser. It's interesting if you look at the negotiations over taking over Indian lands or moving Indians to new lands. Often what was promised at the end of the negotiations was alcohol, mm-hmm. right? And as Native American populations were moved onto reservations, you just look at the movement of whiskey with them, right? And then there would be payments to Native Americans for moving. And then you look at how those payments are literally then used to purchase alcohol. Now, the federal government, I should point out, this was such a serious concern. The federal government at one point banned the selling of alcohol to Native American populations. It was actually the first true alcohol prohibition in America, totally forgotten. But the ban was poorly enforced, to say the least.
But also not all Native Americans wanted alcohol. And I think didn't some leaders go and plead to
Oh, sure. There's plenty of evidence of Native American leaders literally pleading to stop the flow.
Well, that you bring up an interesting point, too, about prohibition, war as a way of a place where drugs are used. And then a byproduct of war, it sometimes is that they become prohibited afterwards.
Right.
Can you give some other examples of
sure.
that?
Sure. What's fascinating is that in the case of alcohol, it's impossible to explain the rise and passage of prohibition in the United States without the context of World War I. It just so happens that the dominant breweries in America were German. And part of the intense and rapidly spreading anti-German sentiment in the country in the lead up to World War I and during World War I was viewing beer drinking as unpatriotic and viewing beer brewers as not only unpatriotic but possibly treasonous.
This notion of patriotism is really interesting because you make the point too that the shift from rum to whiskey in early
right.
American history was against British. The rum was seen as tied to the rum trade and to the British. Also that the shift from tea to coffee
right.
was anti-British.
Yeah, our very consumer tastes are shaped by war. And in fact, it's hard to explain the shift to whiskey in this country without the American Revolution. Rum was the alcoholic beverage of choice after the Revolution. It was disparaged as a British drink and as a drink that the raw materials for processing it locally required imports. And so the whiskey could be produced domestically using corn, which became increasingly accessible with westward expansion.
And then took on this sort of American
sure.
independent
Absolutely.
Aura.
I mean, what's interesting is rum itself was in fact produced in large quantities in the New England colonies, including right here in Rhode Island and Massachusetts were the heart of rum production. But those distilleries basically were never recovered from the American Revolution.
Well, let's keep this notion of patriotism and go from World War One to World War Two then. And that's a perfect time to talk about amphetamines. Mm. And that was eye-opening. I had no idea that soldiers were high and that's how they were getting their jobs done. I'm terribly naive, perhaps, but I had no idea. And you call amphetamines the quintessential drugs of the industrialized era. So can you describe how they were used, especially by Nazis, and what that allowed them to accomplish?
Well, the Germans arguably pioneered pill popping on the battlefield, but it's important to really recognize that not all sides, but many sides used amphetamines. First the Germans, then the British, the Americans, and the Japanese as well. In fact, the Japanese certainly gave them to kamikaze pilots, but also to defense industry workers to keep them working harder and faster and longer. In terms of their use on the battlefield, I mean, the most sort of dramatic illustration of their utility would probably be the German Blitzkrieg, in which the entire operation depends on surprise and speed. And so literally, you know, thousands of pills popped the night before the invasion begins, keeping German soldiers awake for days on out. And
so they just could go and go
and go. Just keep going and going and going. So we pay a lot of attention to, you know, the armor, the machinery, the gasoline needed to keep it going. Well, you also need fuel to keep the soldiers going.
And, yeah, you call them chemically enhanced soldiers.
Absolutely. And so, you know, Sun Tzu once said, speed is the essence of war. He didn't have amphetamines in mind, but he would have been pretty impressed at the ability of amphetamines to speed things up. You could argue that, again, you don't want to overstate it, but you could argue that literally amphetamines help speed up the war.
There's this interesting irony in the case of the Germans, too, because the Nazis looked down on, disparaged people who used drugs or had addictions, and yet they made this exception
Absolutely.
For this uber drug kind of.
Nazi ideology was actually pretty intensely anti-drug. They looked down on alcohol, cigarettes, opiates, cocaine. They wanted the country to be sober, but amphetamines were the privileged exception. Maybe not so surprising. Why? Because amphetamines keep you alert, energetic, focused, driven, and that's precisely what Germany at that time was focusing on, emphasizing, stressing, and it was part of the total mobilization effort was to also chemically enhance the mobilization effort.
But who was making all this methamphetamine?
Well, it's not the meth labs of today, right? No, these are all the major pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, in Germany, there was one major company that basically was the main supplier to the German military. The U.S. had its own pharmaceutical companies that produced it, as well as Japan. These are not marginal, shadowy outfits. These are the biggest players in the world of pharmaceutical production.
Do we know when this drug, methamphetamine, was first used in war?
As far as I can tell, the first sort of large-scale use of the drug on the battlefield was, in fact, the Germans in World War II. I've heard some people mention that it may have made an appearance during the Spanish Civil War, but in terms of just systematic large-scale use, World War II is really credited as sort of the place and context and war that where it really took off.
It's amazing because it was being prescribed for depression.
Everything.
It was a wonder drug.
I mean, Germans actually had, you know, chocolates that you could give housewives.
Yeah.
And
perk them up.
Perk them up, exactly.
Love housework. And did Hitler use drugs?
Oh, Hitler was such a hypocrite because he denounced drug users as weak and debilitated and unhelpful and useless. But he himself, his private doctor, gave him regular injections of all sort of concoctions of drugs, which included amphetamines, but all sorts of other things as well.
That's so interesting. You mentioned the kamikaze pilots, and they also were given injections of amphetamine before going off on their missions. But you also talk about the repercussions in Japan after the war. Describe in what ways it was so destructive and why there and not, say, in these other countries where amphetamines had been used for soldiers.
Different countries recover differently and are affected differently by wartime drug use. And Japan is the obvious case of there being serious and long-lasting consequence of large-scale amphetamine wartime use. There was such production, arguably overproduction, of amphetamines during the war that there were stockpiles built up that at the end of the war were essentially dumped on the civilian population. And Japan, which actually had no previous history of drug epidemics or large-scale drug problems, really had its first national drug epidemic in the 1950s around amphetamines. And the Yakuza, which is sort of a traditional criminal organized crime organization in Japan, long predates this, but amphetamines was their entree into the drug trade.
And how did they resolve the crisis? I mean, it went on for decades, right?
It went on for years, not decades. Though to this day, amphetamines are the drug of choice, illicit drug of choice in Japan. It's just that the epidemic proportions, the sense of crisis around the drug did ease up after the country took it much more seriously, and actually after the country began to recover from more unemployment reduced, this stress was reduced. It's understandable that as a country recovers from war, that it may turn less to drugs to help it cope.
That does make sense. I was amazed to learn that the U.S. military, starting in the Korean War, made dexedrin and a form of amphetamine standard issue for soldiers. And by the Vietnam War, the U.S. military was giving out 225 million doses of dexedrin.
Yeah, what's striking about that case is that, one, the country had actually turned away from amphetamines because previously they'd been perfectly legal and accessible to the general population. But even as the country was turning away from them and they were becoming criminalized and more controlled, the military continued to use them, prescribing them to their soldiers. And the actual pills were probably twice as potent as the pills during World War II.
Yeah, there's this recommended dosage of 20 milligrams of dexedrine for 48 hours of combat readiness. So this was out in the open.
Indeed. You know, these are medically prescribed drugs. In fact, amphetamines are still medically prescribed, Adderall, Ritalin, and so on. This was not an uncommonly prescribed drug in Vietnam. And so people look back at Vietnam and think, when you tell them about drug problems in Vietnam, people think heroin, right? People might think cannabis. But frankly, amphetamines were as serious or more serious problem, not to mention alcohol as well, which we often forget about.
Mm-hmm. But I'm glad you brought up cannabis because it's noticeably absent from your list of six.
Right.
So you found that it was not so prevalent?
It's not that it's not important. It just doesn't make the cut, if you will, in the sense that these other six are much more prominent in their importance and their relationship between drugs and war than cannabis. So yeah, cannabis, you know, weed and war intersect here and there over time. Napoleon's troops actually introduced hashish to Paris, and plenty of GIs smoked dope in Vietnam. But in the overall historical scheme of things, it's just not as prominent as these other drugs. I suppose if I'd written a book, A History of War and Seven Drugs, cannabis would have been the next on the list. But it's just strikingly not as important comparatively. And it's particularly surprising to me. This was one of the most surprising things about the research, was that the world's most popular illicit drug isn't actually as important in terms of war as these other drugs. The other striking thing, which is what people do know about, which is that in the Vietnam War era, cannabis was actually not just not a war drug, it was a peace drug.
Yeah.
I mean, it was part of the anti-war movement.
Make love, not war.
Make love, not war, and you know.
And smoke a joint.
Smoke your, you know, weed, not, and don't go to war. I don't want to say that if you just left it at that, you might think that cannabis has some kind of inherently pacifying anti-war effect. But in fact, what's interesting is cannabis's most important relationship to war historically has actually not been its psychoactive effects, but actually used in the form of hemp for rope, which was hugely important for naval warfare.
Oh, in the Navy, yeah.
And that would have been included, except the book's about psychoactive drugs, and using it for rope just doesn't.
It's doesn't
a side
make
story.
The cut.
It's an important side story, yeah. But it's still a side story.
And so, how did the drug war meet the war on terror? Because the war on terror was about terrorists.
Right. They do intersect and intersect quite intimately after 9/11. What's fascinating in places like Colombia, which had been engaged in a counterinsurgency campaign for many, many years, with the insurgents turning to the country's cocaine industry to help fund themselves, the country, the government of Colombia had, with U.S. assistance and support, long merged counterinsurgency and counter-narcotics. But what was interesting after 9/11 is that Colombian insurgents were suddenly labeled terrorists, as were right-wing paramilitaries who were also drug-financed in Colombia. And so suddenly Washington could more openly support going after insurgents in the name of the war on terror and forget about counterinsurgency, which smacked of Cold War. Now it had a post 9/11 justification. Similarly, in Afghanistan, long history of drugs and war there that goes back to the Soviet invasion of the late 70s. The U.S. invades Afghanistan as part of the war on terror, but what happens is that the crisis in the aftermath and the chaos in the aftermath of the U.S. invasion and the Taliban insurgency regrouping and growing all provided fertile ground for massive growth of the opium trade there, so much so that Afghanistan is now the source of virtually all the world's supply of opium.
Wow. You just made me remember that you make this point that after the Cold War, sort of this shift to not criminalization of drugs only, but declaring a war on drugs gave the military apparatus something to do. I mean, they said as much, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating is that right after the end of the Cold War, this is long before the war on terror, looking for new missions. So historically, the U.S. military was pretty understandably wary and skeptical of unconventional missions like fighting drugs. But they became noticeably more persuadable as the Cold War ended. These kind of irregular, unconventional missions were a source of funding and a source of justifying old programs that they wanted to keep funded.
Right, and they were repurposing technologies.
Repurposing. I mean, you could basically say, well, we're using this radar system to track drug flights. Forget Soviet bombers. We're not worried about those anymore. But look, we can use it to track drug flights, things like that. Again, there was this crucial period between the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the War on Terror where, you know, looking for new enemies, new missions, and so on. After 9/11, obviously, it was easy to justify rising military budgets, but before then, people turned to things like the drug mission to help justify programs and funding.
You've written so many books, and you've talked about a few of them on this show. And what strikes me, Peter, is you're a political scientist. Here you are taking this historical perspective, and you write in a way that is accessible not just to scholars, but to just interested readers. Is that intentional?
Oh, absolutely. Unlike some political scientists, it doesn't make me happy that just my colleagues might read what I write. So I just hate the thought of writing something that only a handful of people ever read. The ambition, not necessarily successful, the ambition is to write in a way that has it both ways. That basically you can maintain the scholarly community and audience, but also write it in a way that is accessible and engaging for a broader interested audience in the so-called public sphere.
Well, I'm going to declare it a success. I mean, it's
Thank you.
Deeply researched, footnoted, and eminently readable. It was just a fascinating and a real pleasure.
Thank you.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Dan Richards and Jackson Cantrell. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm Sarah Baldwin. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more information about this and other shows, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in 2 weeks for another episode of Trending Globally.